between the U.S. and the three Micronesian states we're talking about was codified starting in 1986, 30 years ago, when they signed this COFA deal, the Compact of Free Association, that established this special relationship between the United States and, at first, two Micronesian countries, the Federated States of Micronesia and the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and then later Palau as well. And basically said the U.S. could continue its military dominion over this large chunk of the Pacific Ocean. And in exchange, the U.S. will give some aid to these countries, and residents of these three Micronesian countries can come to the U.S. freely to live and work without a visa. It's kind of a unique privilege. You know, the impact was pretty small for a long time. There just weren't that many people coming over. But then in the past couple of decades, and really the past several years, it's picked up a lot, and it's led to the present situation.
And so the title of your article is America's Real Migrant Crisis. Is the one you've never heard of. Why do you refer to it as, I guess, real migrant crisis? Is that just like in relation to the ones that are getting more attention in bigger news outlets?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, there has been a lot of hype about various groups of migrants and immigrants. We have, you know, we've heard a lot during the presidential campaign about the role, you know, of Mexicans coming into the country and the things that they're allegedly doing, and the dangers posed by Syrian refugees coming into America. And, you know, those dangers haven't really materialized. It's a lot of political talk, but we haven't really seen this mass threat that's been described or anything like that. By contrast, there's this thing that no one's really talking about here on the mainland. And I should say it's quite well known in Hawaii because people are seeing the implications of it all over the place. But here on the mainland, hardly anyone that I've spoken with has even heard of this situation or the COFA treaty. And yet what you're getting is this deal that the federal government made with these other countries, then kind of reneged on part of its promise. And it's leading to, you know, an actually rather desperate situation where a lot of people are coming and finding themselves in poverty and oftentimes out on the streets.
So what part of the Compact of Free Association isn't being held up by the U.S. government, and what's sort of exacerbating this crisis? And also, what is causing the migration crisis to come into more intensity? What's causing people to leave these Micronesian islands?
Sure. Well, I'll talk about the history first. You know, basically 10 years after COFA was first signed, the U.S. Had this, you know, its big welfare reform law that was passed and signed by President Clinton. And it's gotten a lot of attention for the effect that it had on welfare received by people in America's cities and across the country. But there was this little known provision that was buried in there that took away the right of some immigrant groups to get federal benefits like food stamps and welfare payments, which then became known as TANF. And there were some groups that were exempted from it, but for whatever reason, possibly an oversight, the Micronesians were no longer eligible for these benefits that they'd gotten. No one really seemed to notice or pay much attention because it was such a small number of people coming over. But then the problem became clear as more and more of them started coming over, anticipating that they could come for better health care and other things. But health has really been a main driving factor. And then they find out they can't get Medicaid like they thought they might be able to, and they can't get other kinds of financial assistance that can help with the very high cost of living in Hawaii. As for the question of what's driving so many to come over, it's a combination of things. Healthcare is a really big one. The Federated States of Micronesia and the Republic of the Marshall Islands have, by some measures, the highest diabetes rates of any places in the world. And so medical treatment in those countries is very limited. Dialysis centers are non-existent in most parts of the countries. And so it's been very difficult for people to get good healthcare there, and a lot of them are coming over for that reason. Also for better economic and educational opportunity. But the new one that's really starting to come up is the effect of climate change. And particularly in the Marshall Islands, which are very low-lying, often don't come above 6 feet above sea level, there are places that are getting flooded in ways they didn't used to. And we're starting to see what seem to be kind of the first waves of climate refugees, people leaving the Marshall Islands for the United States or for other parts of the region because their homes are soon going to be underwater, or their way of life is getting threatened by the rising seas.
And so that picture in the backdrop of the title of the article appears to be a bunch of people on an island, presumably in the Pacific Islands, and also presumably like in the 50s, just after World War II or something, and they're carrying a bunch of possessions and walking onto a landing craft, military-looking vessel. What's happening there? Do you know what the backstory for that picture is?
Yeah, I believe that one's from 1946, and that was when the military governor, the American military governor who was overseeing the Marshall Islands, went out there and sat down with the chief of the people there and with a group of the folks living there on Bikini Atoll, and basically told them that they would have to move in order to make way for these nuclear tests. The move was supposedly going to be temporary, but as it turned out, people, you know, scientists, no one really knew what radioactive fallout was going to look like or how contaminated these places were going to be. And it turned out that even to this day, they're not really safe to inhabit. So these people left under the impression that they were moving temporarily in order to further this important humanitarian mission. Instead, they found themselves permanently dislocated.
One thing that I really want to touch on in this interview is kind of the cultural backdrop and how this part of the world has been portrayed. I mean, it's definitely been the subject of, you know, colonization in the past 100+ years. I mean, Micronesia and Marshall Islands, those don't sound like indigenous names. Those sound like kind of like diminutive names given by colonizers. And I guess I don't think many people are aware that when we were testing atomic bombs, if they're aware of the testing in the first place, that there were people that inhabited these islands that we, you know, forced off of them. And now I don't know if Bikini Atoll is even inhabitable right now, but I guess these people are essentially invisible, and how obscure the COFA treaty is and how obscure this migration crisis is kind of speaks to how little these people matter to at least the American government and the American media's eyes. Can you kind of speak to like what you see when you spoke to some of these people? Because it seems like you were in communication with some of these people that have come over to Hawaii, or at least Hawaii, or if not the mainland.
Yeah, I do think that they feel significantly overlooked by elements of the government. It's just there are people without much of a voice, because they, even though they have the rights of full-time permanent residents, they aren't citizens, and if they want to become citizens, they have to go through the same green card process as any immigrants, which can be very difficult for anyone coming into the country. But the incentive is a little bit lower, of course, for people who already have residency here. And so, you know, they can't vote. They don't have a whole lot of money to donate to campaigns. There's just, they don't have the same kind of political influence that some other groups might. And so outside of Hawaii, where they are quite visible and people are well aware of this problem, there's not a whole lot of political will to give more dollars to this issue or come up with new solutions. And so I do think that a lot of them feel as if, relative to some other migrant and immigrant groups that are getting a lot of attention, they've been somewhat forgotten.
So like when I think of this part of the world, at least in terms of like what captures the public's attention, I think of, I guess like the most recent thing is like, and this is going to sound kind of silly and pejorative, but like SpongeBob SquarePants takes place like in that backdrop, right? I mean, it's like SpongeBob exists because of the nuclear testing apparently in the Bikini Atoll. Like Bikini Bottom is like where he lives. And so like we just have this like really lighthearted mythology surrounding this area, but it's also, it's like really mired in kind of a dark history. Are people talking about that? Is there anyone in these communities that are kind of advocating for better treatment?
Certainly. I mean, there are active groups of Micronesians who are established, particularly in Honolulu, who are really doing a lot of advocacy around this. And they've set up these centers for Micronesians to come to get assistance with housing, with basic translation needs, with getting access to other social services. Yeah, I mean, I do think that these, you know, I'm not sure about SpongeBob exactly, but there are stereotypes that definitely exist in Micronesia that are making it harder for them. In Hawaii, of the Micronesians that are making it harder for them. There's this perception, as tends to happen with basically any new immigrant group, that they're lazy, they're living off of government dollars, they're not motivated to look for work. And, you know, at least in the case of the people I spoke with, that's certainly not the case. But it has, I think, made it harder for a lot of them to find things like housing, because they do encounter persistent discrimination. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of this quote that I included in my story from Henry Kissinger several decades ago, where when confronted with the relocation of a group of Marshall Islands residents for some missile testing, he said, quote, "There are only 90,000 of them out there. Who gives a damn?" And I think that's kind of the challenge they've faced for decades now, which is that they're just not thought of as a big, influential, important group. They're thought of as, you know, a few scattered islanders, and they don't have the sort of clout or, you know, from a policymaker's perspective, maybe the sort of urgency that other groups do, and so they kind of get left behind.
So looking forward, is there any hope for, I guess, A, increasing the visibility of these people and their plight, and B, maybe like securing any sort of policies that appeal to people who are affected by climate change? You know, is there a such thing? I'm not aware of anything like really like this, but is there such thing as like an ecological asylum or like environmental refugee status in the United States?
That's a good question. That the population of climate refugees is still a very new one and a matter of dispute, of course, because you can't ever attribute any single weather event to climate change. And so it's always been a little bit tenuous. There has been advocacy around this, and I frankly don't know exactly where it's ended up, but governments like the Maldives and others that are threatened by climate change have been advocating on an international level for some policy to address this. I can say specifically for this population, there are reasons for hope. You know, the main one is just that more and more of these people are coming over, and as a result, their voice presumably grows and awareness of their situation grows. They're not just in Hawaii. There are large numbers of them in Arkansas and in Oregon and in other places as well. And so, you know, perversely, as the problems in Micronesia grow and more people come to the United States, the awareness of their problems could also grow, and that could serve to help them. On the other hand, we have a new administration coming in that has not always had the kindest words for people coming from elsewhere. And, you know, given that it hasn't been a top priority of any administration to give more money to this issue, there may not be a lot of hope that things are suddenly going to get better under a Trump administration.
Aaron Weiner, senior editor at Mother Jones, thank you so much for setting aside the time to speak with us.
It's great talking with you.
I'm Kanan Schlesinger with KBOO News.
In Oregon, a person with mental illness can be charged with a nonviolent crime and end up in a jail cell for months in a deteriorating mental state and without restorative treatment. Tune into Prison Pipeline on January 9th to hear Disability Rights Oregon's proposed legislation that will help people with mental illness who become entangled with the criminal justice system. That's Prison Pipeline, January 9th at 6:30 p.m.
The time is 5:57 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. Thank you for turning in to Labor Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Today, we will be speaking with Hyung Nam, Lisa Stiller, a former teacher, and David Young, a retired RN. They're with us from Healthcare for All Oregon. I'm Ann McDonald and co-hosting with Nick Bubb tonight.
Good evening, everyone.
Fernando is out and we're hoping he's going to be okay. So just to jump right in, Hyung, can you give us a little of a rundown? What is Healthcare for All Oregon? What is it trying to achieve?
Yeah, Healthcare for All Oregon is a grassroots nonprofit group in Oregon. And we are trying to achieve a statewide publicly funded universal healthcare plan, which many people call single payer, or we also like to call it an improved Medicare for all, which would be a basically socializing the funding of healthcare coverage for everyone, but leaving the delivery or providers private so that it actually tends to give people more choice and make the system much more efficient so that you don't have to deal with all the billing, co-pays, deductibles, and so on, so that it's a simpler system that covers everyone and that will save because of the efficiency and also the bargaining power it has to negotiate for drug prices. It will save 98% of us in the state money and give us better care. And the idea is that just like Canada started their single payer with one province, the idea is that we make this change and show how this system is a better system and that it can function very well in one state, because Oregon has a population of about 4 million people, and we can compare ourselves to Scandinavian countries have a similar population and have their own healthcare systems. And then the hope is that that is what will lead to changes in other states, just like we've seen with other ballot measures. And then we will have a full national system, which would be even more efficient and even better.
So healthcare is a very complex subject. It can be hard to understand, but basically in a nutshell, the difference between the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare and a single payer system is taking out the insurance companies and having hospitals and doctors funded directly by the state?
Exactly, yes.
And when that started in a province in Canada, it wasn't really popular at first, right? They had to push for that, and then it spread nationally there because it was working.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important point, that it took a grassroots social movement organizing to do that, because there was so much disinformation telling people that, you know, this would lead to communism and, you know,